Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Audio bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by Winamp. Subscribe to TWiT and all your favorite podcasts with the ultimate media player. Download it for free at winamp.com. Video bandwidth for TWiT is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 260, recorded Sunday, August 8, 2010. Sex, Lies, and Contractors. This episode of TWiT is brought to you by Ford, makers of the EcoBoost engine with twin turbos and direct injection. Ford EcoBoost is a powerful and fuel-efficient V6 that's standard on the Ford Taurus SHO. Drive one this week at a Ford dealer near you. And by GoToMyPC. For those of us who work around the clock, access your files and applications around the clock, too, with GoToMyPC. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMyPC.com/TWiT. And by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to Squarespace.com/TWiT. Welcome to This Week in Tech, episode 260. I am Tom Merritt, filling in for the vacationing Leo Laporte. He is he's actually driving his daughter up to college.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that is so sweet.
But we have assembled a fine, fine group of guests, some of my favorite people in the world here, to help us fill in the gaps. Of course, first of all, Molly Wood, executive editor of CNET.com.
I'm so happy to be here.
We're talking tech again together.
Yay! I know, in the same room and everything.
Exactly. Thanks for coming all the way up here. It was great.
Of course, yeah.
Of course, Molly Wood, also host of Buzz Out Loud, a fantastic tech podcast on CNET every day at 10:30 a.m. Pacific.
Yeah, it's like the second best way to get daily tech news.
Every once in a while, I accidentally type live.cnet.com in my Twitter feed still. Until the chat room yells at me. But yeah, so you can find her at cnet.com/Molly. Mm-hmm. Goes to all your stuff?
Goes to all the video.
All the video
the Buzz
stuff.
Report, the tech review, that kind of stuff.
And cnet.com/Molly Rants if you just want the ranty stuff.
In text form.
In text form.
Actual written Ooh. Rants. Yeah.
Written rants.
Yep, that's my deal.
Ritants.
Ritants.
Never mind. Patrick Beja, also hosting.
We missed each other.
Also joining us, host of Le Rendezvous Tech. You can find him at FrenchSpin.com. Welcome, Patrick.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
I am a big fan of many of your podcasts, including the Phileas Club, which is, I think, an ingenious idea, finding people in various areas of the world, bringing them together to discuss the news of the day for the world, as well as news in their area, getting a lot of different perspectives. You just recorded one, right?
Yeah, we recorded an epic 2.5-hour show where Sean Coons, a good friend of mine, wanted to discuss religion. So that's sort of dynamite podcasting there.
Oh, come on. Take on a controversial topic next time. I mean, really, religion.
No, we had a lot of fun. We had people from all over and it was great.
And finally, someone I have been an admirer of for quite a long time, Nilay Patel, managing editor of Engadget.com. And I actually have learned how to pronounce your name correctly now. So, I mean,
well, if you've been an admirer of me for a long time, you have poor taste in dudes, I gotta say.
It is my job and has been for like 5 years to look at all of the tech news of the day. And I have to say, more frequently than other names, Nilay Patel byline shows up in my final lineups, both when I was at Buzz Out Loud and on Tech News Today.
Well, you know, I do try to be as confident and pretentious as possible.
So whoever you're paying to write your posts,
hey, I do that too.
You should give them a raise.
That robot army is really, really that. Man, those are the best 1,000 monkeys I've ever bought.
You should throw that intern a second Diet Coke. you can find, of course, Nilay at Engadget.com. But do you have another URL to promote as well?
You know, I wish I did, but I don't. Everything, you know, my Engadget, you know, pretty much locks us in. I'm not actually allowed to leave the house anymore. Pretty much sit here typing constantly.
Right, right. Well, so if you hear a noise in the background during the show today, you'll understand why.
Yeah, exactly.
The right hand has to keep going.
I'm blogging right now.
Blogging. I'm blogging this.
I just wanted to clear up what my right hand was doing. That's
a good idea. Yeah, we don't want this to go off the rails. As I am filling in for Leo Laporte, we will be talking about Twitter. We'll be revealing someone's World of Warcraft name. We'll be going on about Facebook. Is there anything else I'm missing?
A three-hour show.
It'll be a three-hour show. Yeah. I'm trying to jump in as best I can. There is a big story breaking today, though. TechCrunch saying that the Verizon iPhone rumors are true. That, in fact, they have sources, and they go into a long description of supply chain evidentiary trails that they've followed that say CDMA chips are being ordered by Apple in numbers that imply that they'll have a Verizon iPhone by January.
Lather, rinse, and repeat.
I've never heard this before.
Yeah.
Well, no one's ever claimed that Qualcomm is producing CDMA chips for Apple. I mean, in the past 3 years or so. This rumor has never occurred.
Yes, but now they're giving a time frame. It's January. They never did that before.
I've never heard a time frame before either.
Right. No, they did. I think that the time frame always starts with J. It's either June or July of whatever year you're in.
So January.
Verizon. So the new part is actually annuary. That's the new.
Yeah.
Verizon's CEO has also been signed on to do a keynote at CES. Not that surprising, but everyone's trying to throw that into this rumor mix
That is a little surprising. So that's
okay.
First,
why is that surprising?
Because usually Steve Ballmer does the pre-show keynote, and then like Ford will do the later keynote as part of the official show. Or you know, some other company that you know we actually don't pay that much attention to. Verizon is new, and I think what Verizon's going to do, my hunch is that they're going to do Android tablets in conjunction with Google. That's sort of the time frame we've been hearing for a long time. You know, Google. It's funny, the only Android tablet you can like really go out and buy in the States right now is this like off-brand Augin tablet at Kmart for $150 that's running infringing Google apps. And so that's sort of amazing. That's sort of the Android tablet you can buy, not discounting the Arcos tablets, but they're sort of harder to find in the States. So I think the big push is going to be Google and Verizon coming on stage together at CES being like, check out our new tablet strategy. Well, and that makes a lot of sense to me. Verizon to show up without Apple and be like, check out the new iPhone makes no sense.
I hate to give credence to this rumor again, but I mean...
You have been predicting this for a while.
Yeah, we all know it's coming. I mean, I think there's no question that Apple is eventually going to open up to other carriers. What I find weird and surprising about this is my assumption has always been they won't make a Verizon iPhone until it's LTE, and that they weren't going to make a CDMA iPhone. And that's the part of this that I still find a little bit implausible, that they would be, at this point, when Verizon has already started testing, very limited testing, but some testing of LTE networks, right, in some areas, that they would be ordering large quantities of this basically outdated technology.
The press release that says that Ivan Seidenberg will be delivering the keynote says he will highlight the company's vision for its LTE 4G wireless technology.
And it wouldn't surprise me if they said that's going to include iPhone. But then that doesn't really work with this rumor. Yeah, it's just that doesn't work with the Qualcomm CDMA chip.
Because they do have dual mode chips, right? But that's those are bigger, they're more complicated, they're undoubtedly going to involve more battery drain. All of that seems like compromises to me. I don't think Apple's the sort of company that wants to get away from AT&T so badly that they're going to make huge compromises on battery life and maybe even size to get dual mode CDMA LTE. I think they're more than happy to wait. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do they have to lose? They're selling the iPhone as fast as they can make them, right? They keep saying it. We can't make them quickly enough.
I totally agree.
And as soon as the white one comes on, whenever that is, I think they're going to sell even more.
Is that thing seriously not out yet? You still can't get the white one?
Still can't make it. Walt Mossberg is the only person in America.
Of course he is.
Well, the best rumor I've seen as to why is they can't figure out how to stop light from coming out of the back. I'm just like, why don't you turn that into a feature? It's the new glowing back.
Yeah, like a flashlight.
It's revolutionary.
It's like a warm, cozy nightlight.
Just give it a name, like iLight.
The nightlight phone.
The iNight light.
Amazing. No other phone can both make phone calls and keep you safe at night.
That's right. We think you're going to love it.
Make you a target for snipers.
It's just gorgeous.
Well, I'm glad you pointed this out, Neelai, because I didn't realize he was doing the key keynote. So he's replacing Ballmer. I just thought he was doing one of the, because they have those later keynotes.
I don't think he's replacing. No, he's Ballmer just one of the keynotes.
Yeah, so okay. Ballmer does the pre-show keynote the day before CES officially
He's still
starts,
doing that.
Which is always a little stupid because we all go to that. It's like CES already started for the press.
Right.
Because Mike Schott's doing it. I have no idea.
They always have. They always have a passel of keynoters, right? Mm-hmm. They do four. They've usually got like Michael Dell or somebody like that. So it's not totally surprising.
Palm.
These all...
No, Palm does an event. Dell doesn't do anything anymore. They do it off-site where they're like... They pull out a product that they're going to announce in the next 6 months. They don't tell anything about it, and they put it away. And then Intel usually closes out the show with their huge keynote.
So it's not that unusual that they would have somebody to basically replace the Dell, you know, the Dell package. And Verizon's been a big deal.
It is interesting to see Verizon come into that mix, and I think the tablet theory that you put out there is right. But this 4G LTE line in the press release adds a little fuel to the intrigue fire. However,
we've gotten rumors that they're launching test markets like in 2011. So that makes a lot of sense. They're say, look, we're turning it on in Boise, Idaho, you know, wherever tiny test markets they have.
And even just if they don't have the iPhone by then, they're going to hint at it because they want it. The thing we do know is that Verizon wants the iPhone. And they have said very publicly, we would love to have a Verizon iPhone. It's just that Apple's been holding out. And I think the thing they're holding out for is LTE.
Well, it would seem very strange that Apple would go for the limited LTE network already. It would seem a little bit too soon. I don't know. I would think from the outside. But about that CDMA chip, don't they already produce CDMA iPhones for other markets?
No.
I don't know. GSM, really? GSM is the global standard. There were those weird little tests where they were showing app like data requests on a CDMA iPhone, and that was, you know, part of the. They think there's a possibility they've been testing it.
They've likely made a CDMA iPhone,
right? I'm sure they have,
but not a factory production model.
Are they really going to re-engineer it? I don't know. The dual chip is a possibility, I guess. We'll see. We'll have this rumor to kick around at least 20 times between now and CES.
There's no way Apple's going to allow Verizon to announce an iPhone at CES.
Yeah, that does not happen.
I think that's 100% sure.
Unless Steve Jobs is also there.
Don't even. That's not going to happen.
Awesome. Somebody Twitter iPhone, that.
I mean, that is,
Verizon CEO Steve Jobs will totally be on sale.
Let's just make that into your rumor right now.
Yeah.
He is going to be there. And then it will
try
happen.
To start for months is that the white iPhone is the CDMA iPhone.
Oh.
He's been working on it for months, like just feeding it out. And we've seen it pop up here and there.
So what you're saying is the white iPhone is the CDMA iPhone?
Oh, absolutely.
Take that to the bank. Totally Twitter that right now.
Verizon CEO Ivan Seidel will introduce the white CDMA iPhone. Guaranteed.
Done. And with Steve Jobs on stage with him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Why not?
Awesome.
Icing on the cake.
Mm-hmm.
While we're at it, Flash is coming to iPhone 4.
That's actually, we're not making that up.
Sort of. You got to jailbreak it and then you can install something called Frash, which is an homage to Strong Bad.
Totally.
Yes.
Oh.
It's the best workaround to adding Flash to your iPad and iPhone.
As long as you're willing to jailbreak.
As long as you're willing to jailbreak.
Yeah.
And it's not done. So Comex, who's the guy who developed it, says it's alpha quality. So you should, you know, buyer beware, to run it. It'll probably kill your battery really fast. And again, to install it, you know, involves some steps. But it's there. You know, we always knew the jailbreak guys would be the ones to do it, right? There was never any, I never had any doubt that they would be the ones to figure it out.
Yeah.
It's just funny because it's like, once that's out there, like sort of the last like big nerd objection to the iPhone and not having Flash is sort of gone. It's like, well, Adobe should have just put out a jailbreak version of Flash like years ago. This conversation would have been over.
It's true.
Jailbreak in their phone.
I think the nerds though who have decided like, I'm just not doing that, you know, philosophically, they're not going to be convinced by the fact. I mean, I guess, you could say, like, there's a moral high ground to be taken. I hacked it and I'm running Flash on it or whatever. But it's like, I think most of those nerds, including myself, have now just defected to Android and are happily living over there with the Froyo and the Flash, you know.
Well, you can add
download. So
Using Flash on an Evo today. It was actually really, like, impressive.
Yeah.
It works, you know.
Yeah. I was going to suggest, I mean, if you get an Evo, you already have Flash and the battery problems pre-installed.
Exactly.
You don't need to jailbreak it.
It's just...
Yeah, that's going to be my question, actually. is now that we have all these fantastic Android phones with Flash, is it actually worth it? Do you guys use it? Or is it like, okay, I can do it if I want, but I actually never do?
Well, I mean, it sort of depends on what your use case is. Like, it's nice to be able to stream one of these live shows, right? Like, there was one day when I was driving and I was like, oh, I can totally like start streaming TNT and just have it listen, you know, have it playing on the phone on the seat. Like, I'm not watching it, but I can hear it. Or you know, those frequent cases where the phone, honestly, is the device that I'm using when I'm sitting on the couch, sort of just checking my email and surfing. And it's nice if somebody has sent me a link to a video that I can watch without having to kind of get up and go to a real computer.
Restaurant websites on the go.
There you go.
Being able to have Flash is like killer app for me.
Yep.
But, you know, it's like, but I have a workaround because on the iPhone I have menu pages and that works fine. You know, it's like, it's just one of those things where it's, now that it's there, I don't worry about it anymore. And when I go back to the iPhone and I don't have it, you know, it's as irritating as it ever was, which was actually not so irritating at all. But it's nice to have. It's one of those things where it's like, well, now I have it. Like, why have we made such a fuss about it? Like, here it is.
I have to say, like, on the iPad, I find the lack of Flash supremely noticeable and annoying. I mean, really, to the point that I just, like, usually use my netbook instead. I mean, I have to kind of come up with reasons now to use the iPad if it's not entertaining my child, which honestly is its primary purpose.
What are the sites in particular that you're trying to get to that just fail?
Mainly, I am trying to watch video. And then often those restaurant websites. And then there are just sites with like Flash plus JavaScript, right? That doesn't work really well. Like, I wanted to look up, I was going to see Salt, and I wanted to look on runp.com and see, like, when would be the good opportunities. You know, nothing doing. And then add to that the fact that the Google Docs, you can't edit, like, a Word doc. It's just kind of like, all right, this thing...
RunP is great.
That's
by the way.
That's not Flash, though, is it?
RunP is awesome. That's not a Flash thing. That's like an additional barrier, but it's kind of a Google problem. I'm not blaming the iPad for it. It's just that, you know, it compounds.
RunP is the site that tells you when in the movie is a good time to go to the bathroom.
It's awesome, and it's kind of spoilery. So they actually hide the text, and you have to highlight it to see, like, if you don't want to get spoiled, then you highlight the text to see, like, this is a good time. But it tells you when it's a good time during the movie to go pee.
What time in?
Yeah. It's so smart.
That's amazing.
But they have Flash?
They have some JavaScript thing or something. For some reason, it doesn't work on my phone.
What's funny to me is when I'm using the iPad and an embedded video does play. And you're just kind of
you're like, whoa.
You're like, wait, that works? That's amazing technology.
Steve Jobs said it
was
magical.
Like 75% of the video on the web was available on the iPhone. He said it.
That was an unbelievably clever dissembly, basically. Because what he said is, you know, 90% of the video on the web is encoded in something other than Flash, which is totally true. It's just that 90% of that same 90% is then being presented in a Flash player. And so it is still wrapped in Flash, even though it might be encoded as an MOV or something else. And it was just, it was so disingenuous. It was like, well, yeah, but it's all on the web and Flash.
Right. I was trying to get on
a couple of might be a little off topic now. Whoops.
We're doing our job.
We just implemented with Viddler, like, HTML5 video playback, and like people are freaking out about it because now they can use it on their phones and on the iPad. And it's like, okay, well, you know, there's something to be said for like these popular devices that don't have Flash, and all people really want is the video. Because nobody ever complained that they couldn't play our Flash ads. They only complained that they couldn't watch our videos.
Yeah.
Right, and as soon as we saw them up, nobody complains anymore. Well, our readers don't complain about Flash. I mean, they complain about Flash because they're Engadget readers, but not because of Engadget.
A lot of people...
Is this complicated?
I got it.
I follow.
Whoa. What? This is... Okay, I'm sorry. I just got a little blown away by an advertisement on this New York Times page. I was about to transition us into talking about Mr. Papermaster.
Was
Mark
it the bamboo
Papermaster.
Touch?
There is an advertisement... that says Stuart Elliott's in advertising email. Sign up for Stuart Elliott's exclusive column, see a sample, and it includes my email address, right? Except it's not my email address. Mm. At least it's not an email address I have used in this decade or the past one. It's an email address I haven't used since 1999.
Is it the one you originally used to register with the New York Times?
I guess so. Probably back in the 90s. I'll give it to you. It's acedetect@concentric.net. It's the email address that gave me the username acedetect.
That's adorable.
It doesn't work anymore.
And also
or maybe it's you from the past who's trying to tell you something.
That's really funny.
It's you from the past.
I must sign up
for this newsletter.
Reaching out to you through the newyorktimes.com.
All right. Sorry for that digression. But Mark Papermaster, who is the Apple executive in charge of hardware for the iPhone, among other things, mm-hmm. has left the company. And all the good rumors say he has been asked to leave the company. And then, of course, the wilder rumors say he's gotten fired over the AntennaGate problem.
Mm-hmm. Is there any doubt that's
what it is somewhat? He joined the company a year ago from IBM, right? And a year afterwards, he's like, well, I'm going away. I want to take vacations. It's obviously what it is.
It's got to be. Yeah. I mean, he joins the company. He does that thing. That's like his big claim to fame, probably, from the hardware, you know, the hardware design.
Well, no, he was a system on a chip guy. He was a processor guy. So I think he came over. I mean, he came over as, you know, head engineer of mobile devices.
Mm-hmm.
But his, you know, he was a processor guy at IBM. He was a microprocessor architecture guy.
Yeah.
Now,
he says he oversees Apple. Oh, sorry. The new
right,
guys.
No, but his coming to Apple was very controversial as well, right? Because IBM actually sued him and sued Apple for, am I totally nuts here? They sued him and they sued Apple for violating his non-compete with IBM, and eventually they settled and he got to come over. So, I mean, his entire tenure at Apple has been controversial.
Right.
You know, his leaving now, it's like, well, who knows? I mean, Bob Mansfield has been the iPhone engineering guy in their videos and their promo materials the entire time. You know, Papermaster was never around. We never saw what he did. The way that Apple publicly shows off its other executives like Scott Forstall or Johnny mm-hmm. Ive or Phil Schiller. Bob Mansfield has always been that guy. So did he leave over the antenna?
Maybe. Or is he just not very good on camera?
Right. Who knows?
Yeah. Or was that like he failed at that part of the job, so that's why he's leaving? They're like, Mark, you know, we've put you in front of the camera a few times now, and it turns out you're just really unattractive, and we're going to have to let you go.
Also, your name is kind of stupid, so maybe.
According to John Gruber, though, the thing that makes you wonder if it's antenna-related is that according to John Gruber of Daring Fireball, who is basically, let's be honest, the unofficial mouthpiece of Apple these days, he was known around Apple as the antenna guy. Like, he was given at least internal credit for the being, quote, the guy responsible for the antenna. He was also then conspicuously absent from all the iPhone 4 promotional material. He wasn't at the press conference, even though supposedly he was really, you know, the hardware guy.
Right. Which the press conference, you could say, oh, well, he's taken the fall. They're not going to let him go to the press conference. They're in the process of getting rid of him.
Right.
The videos, though, that was before any antenna gate had ever broken. They filmed those long before.
Yeah.
So
because they knew.
Gruber's trying to imply in that posting is there may have been problems with him already. He may not have been fitting in before.
And, you know,
antenna
and they said gate. That from the get go, mm-hmm. actually, during the lawsuit. When they were, you know, they're doing discovery and Apple's emails are being released about how they hired him and all this stuff. One of the emails was from Bob Mansfield. And he said, Papermaster is incredibly smart. He knows the field very well, but he is a long shot in every other way for this job. And maybe that just turned out to be true. Right? Maybe he was really smart about microprocessors and antenna design, but he didn't fit the culture of Apple, or he wasn't good at leading team. We don't know why he left.
Or he was both, right? He was a bad fit, and he was a controversial hire, and he was sort of troublesome. And then on top of that, he was responsible for the antenna, and that was just like one thing too far. Who knows?
Bob Mansfield's taken over his responsibilities, though.
Yeah.
You know, I'll put it to you this way. Johnny Ive now has led the design of many Apple products that have significant flaws that the company has had to take PR hits for, right? iPods that scratch really easily, the G4 Cube that cracked all over the place, the Magic Mouse, which is the Mighty Mouse, which is the dumbest mouse ever designed, right?
That's true, but
those were design things. Like, he was like the Mighty, you know, you can't deny that the Mighty Mouse looks lovely, even though it doesn't work for Dookie.
But the Apple lost a class action lawsuit over the iPod Nano, scratching too easily and too much, right? I mean, that's a flaw. That's a major design decision that turned out to be a problem. And they didn't ask Johnny Ive to leave. Right? You know, I think
that's why I think it was probably a combination of things. It was probably
agreed.
Yeah.
Absolutely agreed.
Yeah.
I think he could have gotten they could have gotten rid of him over the antenna gate thing. I think it was a lot more important and impactful for the company than the scratching iPods. And also Johnny Ive, the example which you're taking, I would argue that he's a lot more important than Mr. Papermaster company at this point. They couldn't, you know, we couldn't imagine them getting rid of Johnny Ive. It would be almost like he's the second most important person after Dobbs.
Well, now. Yeah. No, I'm saying but when he designed the iPods that scratched or the G4 Cube that cracked, you know, he wasn't quite Johnny Ive yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but he made them look really pretty. He didn't manufacture the materials. He made them look really pretty, and I think that's mainly his charter, to be honest.
Sometimes
industrial design encompasses more than that, but, you know.
Well, no, here, do you want to hear my Johnny Ive impression? Well, you know, if you've got to think about the material, right, and the material and the design are the same thing. See, it's good.
But he's like, that's not bad, actually. That's pretty good. But Jonathan Ive is above the materials. Look, he's all about the
muscles, right? And his haircut, and it's just... It works in a Jaguar.
I got to say, he did not used to be that hot. That is somewhat of a recent development, and good for you. He is industrial designed himself into a whole new level.
They do. Maybe that's all they needed to do was to give Papermaster
a
makeover.
That was a really sassy Molly Muppet.
Yeah.
He just designed himself.
Damn. That is magical, Johnny.
Or maybe they just didn't like. Maybe they just didn't like meeting with him in person.
Maybe. Yeah. They just didn't like
Maybe they should have used Go to My PC.
To hang out with
Papermaster. Oh,
my God. Oh, you did not? Really?
Fantastic.
He has not lost it, people.
Ladies and gentlemen, is how it's done.
Yes. For many of us, jobs aren't just from 9 to 5. You got to work around the clock. Whenever an idea comes to you, whenever you have a little spare time, whenever you're inspired or motivated to do something, you need to work on it, which means we don't have all of the files or applications we need right at our fingertips. If this sounds to you like the way you're going to work, you should try out Go to My PC, sponsor of TWIT. Go to My PC means you can get what you need done whenever the mood strikes you. You can access your office or home computer and all the files and applications on it from anywhere, no matter where you are. So try it out, why don't you? For 30 days free. I'm not saying it will save your career, but it can't hurt. So check it out by going to gotomypc.com/twit and be able to access your files anywhere you go, anytime. gotomypc.com/twit. We thank them for their support. We thank them for their support. We do all kinds of things for their support.
We
thank
them.
We always thank them. I don't think Go to My PC or anything would have helped HP CEO Mark Hurd.
Something is rotten at HP. Like, what is up with these people?
So not only has he resigned over the sexual harassment investigation, but now there seems to be a little after bickering between HP and Hurd over exactly what happened. When the announcement was made on Friday, it was, we didn't find any sexual harassment violations, but he did violate policy. And so he's going to step down and we're going to give him a severance package. But now on Twitter and elsewhere, there's been a little like he filed fraudulent expense reports. No, I didn't. Mm-hmm. This is turning out much worse for
HP.
This
whole story is bonkers. Like, I love it for some reason.
Yeah,
I do too. Whatever. No, I could not agree more. You know,
it's
awesome.
So ridiculous. It's like there's this like fake sexual harassment claim. And then every side just insists that they were just really good friends. Right, which is like at least have it be worth it.
But
you know
also
what I mean?
that even if there was a relationship that he is the CEO of HP and he can't afford to conduct his own affair, that he would have to falsify expense reports that were related to the cost of the affair. Like, dude, you can't pony up for your own hour-long hotel room stays? Like, I don't understand.
No, but they were so just confusing. Friends. They weren't doing anything. They didn't need the app. They could just go get coffee.
Well, and that's why he's...
That's the funniest part about this.
That's the what he said.
That he then expensed.
Well, and that's the defense on his side is like, why would I do this? It was because one of the controversies is she got paid for work that was never done. He says, well, it's because, well, I don't know if he says, but that side says she was signed up for a contract that was canceled less than 30 days before it was supposed to start. And that's normal terms for a contract is that you go ahead and get paid if you cancel less than 30 days. Mm-hmm. It's just a coincidence that it's this person. So, you know, who do you believe?
But now the Wall Street Journal is reporting, apparently, that people familiar with the situation, man, there are so many of those out there, told the Journal that Hurd and the unidentified contractor reached some kind of settlement over her charges, but that it didn't involve the exchange of money. But that there was, in fact, enough of an infraction that there was some sort of settlement. But the other thing, and maybe
this is... What kind of settlement doesn't involve money?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, well, maybe like future jobs or like a diplomatic posting.
I was wrong.
Well, if you look at it from the very like cut and dry, like I'm a lawyer perspective, right? So, I mean, to me, it just sounds like they had this weird relationship. I mean, I'm just assuming that there's like some bump and grind going on because it doesn't make any sense.
Come on, there always is.
Has to be, right?
Yes.
But
I think that there was, I sort of feel like there was, I mean, I'm not trying to, I don't want to sound really jaded about the world, but like this is the kind of thing that a CEO goes down for. Like in this day and age, a CEO gets the boot over bump and grinding with a contractor and or kind of goofy expense reports. Something about this is super fishy.
Here's my dry like lawyer interpretation. So they're like they're fooling around, and then she wants something and can't get it. So she says, "Well, I'll sue you for sexual harassment." He calls the bluff. She hires Gloria Allred, celebrity lawyer. Gloria writes HP. HP freaks out, right? Because it's their CEO who's mm-hmm. doubled their stock price since he's been the CEO. They freak out. They do their investigation. They find that there's no sexual harassment because there's consensual activity going on mm-hmm. where she is, right? This is consensual. So, the harassment lawsuit it holds in the water. But Heard has been essentially flying this contractor he hired around on HP's dime, to just be friends. And that's not okay, right? Because it's the chief executive of the company defrauding his company, embezzling money from the company.
But senators stay in office for that kind of thing. That's the thing that I find so amazing. Like, why does
the it's not because the senators do something bad that it should be allowed for everyone to do it. I mean, I would take the opposite, view of this, Molly. I would say senators should not stay in office for doing it.
Oh, no. Yeah, I'm not saying that I approve. I am saying that my jaded view of this is like, really?
You did say that. You just did.
No, come on. What I'm saying is I can't believe that they let him go over this, considering that he's doubled the stock price, considering that he actually brought them out from under the shadow of the Fiorina scandal, considering that, all that he really did to turn around this company, the fact that he was then ousted over this, which I don't mean to suggest that it's minor, but it's like really, it seems fishy to me. I think there's more to it, is all I'm saying. I think more is going on.
So HP said, we need you to leave. And he said, no, I don't want to. And they said, there will be a lawsuit unless we settle with this woman and you leave. And I think that that's what drove it, that whoever this woman is said, unless he leaves, there will be a lawsuit. And the last thing HP needs right now is a sexual harassment, like high profile, scandalous sexual harassment lawsuit. So he leaves, she gets paid, and HP gets to say things like, we're upping our guidance for the third quarter. And I think that was just the very cold, calculating move that they made. They said, well, if you don't leave, she files, and we don't want her to file, so you have to go. And that's what it sounds like to me. And that's probably why he's so unhappy right now, because I don't think he wanted to leave. I think he probably said what Ollie said, which is, I'll pay you back. Who cares what I do with a few thousand dollars? Like, I'm the CEO. Like, I can fly whoever I want around, right? And check out my performance. And I think that's why all of a sudden these rumbles of it didn't happen quite this way.
And there is this Ali Insider story today that's saying that Heard's people are denying the things that the board of directors said. So you may be right that the board forced him out and he is feeling like it's over the top.
There's an article on
is that but his statement is on the board, the PR that HP put out, there's a statement from him being like, I didn't live up to these values.
Yeah.
And then 24 hours later, 48 hours later, he's like, it turns out I did, which is just strange.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a lot going on here that we'll never know.
Reuters has an article where they quote Michael Malone, who wrote the book The HP Way, mm-hmm. about how Fiorina ran afoul of a lot of entrenched interests at HP during her tenure and was essentially forced out because she wasn't following the HP way. And she complains that people at HP were resistant to change. And now he thinks, Malone, the author, thinks that Heard kind of ran afoul of that same culture. And they're trying to reassert what's called the HP way. And that is the sort of culture that was created by Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard back in the day. And there's a lot of old timers still at HP who have momentum behind them. And you see this happen at companies where the person in charge can fall to the interests that are entrenched and almost like a meme, these sort of systems of thinking that perpetuate themselves over the decades. And it just spits them back out. And that may be what happened to Heard.
There's a really interesting quote in this Ali Insider today. story today saying that if Heard defrauded HP by submitting bogus expense reports to cover up a relationship, or worse, embezzled money by having the company fly his love interest around on the company dime, he should be fired for cause and not get a dime of severance. Instead, he was let go with a package that is now costing HP shareholders $10 billion. And so Ali Etzer is saying, you know, the board owes shareholders an explanation.
No, it's $12 million in cash, and then another like $30 to $40 million thereabouts, depending on the stock price when things vest, in stock, right? And then, oh, and then 18 months of health and dental, just because we have to be nice. And then it's the stock price that fell, right?
Yeah, that's what it's saying is it's costing shareholders $10 billion total once you put add in all the severance and the stock price drop. So you do have to wonder if it is that HP Way thing. Like, what the hell are the board? What is the board doing?
Do you know why? But so if you we put up the 8K, the SEC 8K that explains the severance agreement. And the reason he's getting the cash payment is that he's agreed to not sue HP in the future for wrongful termination.
But he didn't agree to grumble about them on the internet.
Like
apparently.
A lot.
Exactly. So
he's
allowed to mutter as much as he likes, but that's why his name isn't connected closely to any of these reports.
Yeah.
That's why its source is familiar, people briefed on the matter. It's not Mark Heard says, I was fired for no reason, HP made the wrong move, I'm suing.
You know who a source familiar with the matter is? Mark Heard.
Yeah, exactly.
He's probably the most familiar with these matters.
Mark Heard, say. But again, you know, sure, you know, it looks bad. You know, I think my aggrieved headline on Engadget was HP CEO Mark Heard rewarded with $40 million severance package for harassing contractor or something. You know, it's like, it definitely feels wrong that he's being paid to leave after defrauding his company. But from HP's perspective, a lawsuit here would have been even worse, right? The former CEO sue HP for termination, that's bad. And that's going to depress the stock price even further. So, I mean, this really feels like HP is cutting its losses and just trying to move on. They're just like, here's money. So everybody happy? Here's some money. Please shut up. Okay? And, like, that's what it sounds like to me.
Also,
I really want this one.
That would only work if he actually did it, if he was actually very, like, he was clearly guilty of what he's being accused of. So then him then coming and saying, I did nothing wrong is sort of, strange. Okay, Molly, you won me over. I think there's something fishy. It's something else.
Thank you.
I think he did something wrong, but not as wrong as HP is making it out to be. And so that's why you're getting the grumbling, not the outright protest, but the grumbling of like, this is making me look worse than it should have because I really didn't much wrong.
So my shady interpretation here is that she threatened a lawsuit. And to erase the possibility of the lawsuit and to get her to settle and be quiet, they had to fire him. And to get him to not sue them for wrongful termination after he was fired, they had to pay him a severance.
Yeah, but do you think
we should write the movie version of this?
You don't think a multinational company the size of HP can make her go away, can settle out of court? You know, I mean, I cannot imagine a world in which the lawsuit is that damaging. Especially since now there's this breaking news, like she has come forward and said, you know, I'm really sorry that he got fired and we didn't have sex or any other form of intimate relationship. And
wait, really?
I did not have sex with that CEO.
This just popped up on Twitter.
So Molly, what would be your Hollywood worthy conclusion to that story? I'm curious, what would you imagine is going to happen if this is a movie?
The conclusion, well, hopefully they run away and live happily ever after not having sex or whatever.
Yeah, no, they're going to move to the Virgin's Neck together. They're going to walk the Appalachian Trail together.
Yeah, maybe. They're going to go have like a monk-like life together.
This is a New York Times story, right, that you're looking at?
Yeah, I'm seeing it on Ali Insider, but yeah, it's like...
Jodie Fisher. Appeared in a number of steamy movies, including Sheer Passion and Intimate Obsession, so she can play herself in Patrick's movie. I was prepared for those events, worked very hard, and enjoyed working for HP. I was surprised and saddened that Mark Heard lost his job over this. That was never my intention.
Yeah, I have a feeling that Tom may be right, that there was something. And if that's true, if the board kind of used this as a reason, like the big stick to lever him out of HP, then I sort of think that they have not done right by their shareholders because it's cost them a lot of money. And also, this guy was, by all accounts, a successful CEO.
Now, if even her is coming out saying that's not what I wanted, it probably means she wasn't going to sue, which means, again, there's something fishy and HP wanted to get rid of him. I mean, wow, it's getting super interesting.
It is, and it's also evolving literally by the second. Like, we'll probably have another update by the end of the show.
No, this is great. She's a political science major from Texas Tech University, so she has a degree in poli-sci, was vice president of a commercial real estate committee, worked on the House Select Committee on Narcotics Abuse and Control before she went to HP. And she's been an actress in R-rated movies, says New York Times.
R-rated movies. An actress identified in the HP scandal.
NBC television show Age of Love. Yeah, so this, I haven't seen this. This story just keeps getting better and better.
It does.
Look, if she's so sorry.
He's going to keep typing with his right hand for a gadget now.
I think she was so sorry about this. Why did she file a sexual harassment claim?
Because I
her attorney?
Think she was totally intending for this to go the horrible, awful way that business as usual incidents like this usually go, which is she files a claim, HP pays her a bunch of money, and she goes away. I mean, I really believe that was probably the plan, right?
If you want to get really conspiratorial, Heard encourages her.
This statement says, I resolved my claim with Mark privately without litigation. Do not intend to comment on it further.
And so there was not going to be a giant lawsuit. And then all of a sudden the board was like, I don't know, these expense reports look a little irregular. You're out of here? What? You know, it's just bizarre.
In a world. Where expense reports are fraudulent.
I am in big trouble because I can never remember exactly how much the taxi costs. Like, I'm sorry.
That's where it's coming from. You're actually afraid that you're going to get ousted.
I am nervous. This is not a comfortable precedent for me.
I've been angling for my $12 million severance from Engadget for a couple days now.
Now you know.
I've gotten more and more suspicious.
Yeah. Now you've got a how-to.
That's right. Ms. Fisher may be looking for work.
The BlackBerry story.
I'm looking for a softcore actress to come to dinner with me a few times a week and not report it accurately. If anybody's interested, just give me a call.
No sex necessary.
You need to find them.
Yeah, exactly.
Apparently. You
know just where to be find. My close friend. And then, you know, we'll see how it goes.
This is making the BlackBerry story pale in comparison.
IMDb?
She
this
was
is amazing.
On Silk Stockings? That is awesome.
93 Silk Stockings.
This story is glorious. This is the best tech story to come along in a
There
year.
Needs to be a car wreck.
You're right. Like that, the Gizmondo guy.
Yeah,
totally.
That's all we're missing.
Man, she should run away with the
Gizmondo
guy.
And a bag of money that they uncover somewhere.
Yep, and hopefully some Coke.
A cola.
Because why not?
Well, because there's no sex, so it's going to be Coca-Cola.
It's going to be, right.
And I just want to read this like random IMDb, because these titles are also good. So we've got Intimate Obsession in 1992, Silk Stockings in 93, Little Big League, just randomly in the middle there, Body of Influence 2, Dead by Dawn, Sheer Passion, and Blood Dolls as Jody Cody.
As Jody Cody. Yeah.
Well, that's good, because her name's Jody, so she didn't, you know, she could respond naturally.
Oh, man, this story. This is like, you know, this is the stuff that we don't run on Engadget, right? It's like not important now, but it's so good. It's so juicy.
Seriously, Jace said, when did Twit turn into Access Hollywood?
Seriously.
When did Tech News turn into Access Hollywood?
Oh, all right. We'll talk about the BlackBerry thing now.
Yes, in the Middle East.
The challenge is going to be to make the BlackBerry story as interesting.
Right.
Here's your challenge.
How are we going to sex this up?
So Saudi Arabia has come to an agreement with BlackBerry over allowing the service to continue. They were threatening to get rid of it, to block the messenger service, particularly of BlackBerry in Saudi Arabia. It was down for about 4 hours on Friday. Then it came back up. And now they say they've come to an agreement where BlackBerry will run a server in Saudi Arabia or possibly provide some other kind of access. The details are still sort of dribbling out. Mm. But RIM was really resistant to this, like right up to the day that Saudi Arabia said no. It started with the United Arab Emirates saying they were going to do the same thing in October. Then Saudi jumped in and moved up the deadline.
Almost 2 years ago, it started with India saying, we are worried about the security implications of BlackBerry as smartphones become more popular in this country.
Emirates were the first to put a deadline on it and say, by October, we're going to shut off all these services, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, no, but India put a deadline on it, but then, you know, I will just say that the Indian infrastructure and the bureaucracy there, deadlines don't mean a lot. But, I mean, there was a deadline in India for a long time.
RIM was like, oh, that's an Indian deadline. Forget about it.
Yeah, exactly.
But the Saudi deadline became the worst because it came within a few days of Saudi Arabia saying we need messenger service blocked unless we can get a tap. RIM said, you know, it's encrypted end to end. We don't have the keys. We couldn't give you the data if you wanted. Mm-hmm. Now it turns out, oh, I guess we can operate a server and I guess we can give you access. What's really going on in this story? What has RIM said that is not exactly true and what isn't here?
Right. It sounds like
I see what you're doing. You're opening the door for making the story more interesting. What is really going on?
What's RIM's IMDb profile have to say?
No, how many episodes of Silk Stockings has RIM been on?
It does sound like RIM has caved a little bit. I mean, one suspects and has suspected all along that the UAE and Saudi Arabia have been really saying what we want is the ability to monitor traffic on these networks, and that RIM has said, sorry, you know, our security is too good. We're encrypted end to end and we store the data offshore, and that's the deal. But that they have maybe now said, you know, yeah, we want to remain the global language of business, if you will. And so, okay, we'll put some servers in your country.
I think RIM was also gambling on the business community in these countries, putting pressure back. Mm-hmm. And that's why they played it right up to the deadline.
Yeah.
Because the folks who do business in Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, now Kuwait, Indonesia has made some, or I think it was Singapore maybe, has made some remarks that they are interested in having some sort of situation like this. The business users don't want these services blocked. They don't want their email blocked. They don't want their web blocked. They don't want Messenger blocked. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work out that way. So they kind of had their bluff called, it sounds like.
I think they did.
Well, no, but this is a structural issue for RIM, right? This is the way BlackBerry's work, is that you have a server that, you know, the authorities can look at and say, well, all the traffic is going through that server. We want access to that server. And they can't say that to Google. They can't say it to Microsoft. They can't say it to Apple, right? They can't say it to Nokia, because none of these countries run, or companies rather, run a single server where every phone connects to it and all the traffic is routed through this network of servers. And that's, I mean, that is both the strength and the weakness of the BlackBerry design, where you have the BBM server, where you have the BIS server for the consumers, and, you know, then you have the enterprise servers that are businesses. Well, when you have all Microsoft system, every business has its own Exchange server. And so it's harder for the UAE or India or Indonesia to say, we need access to all of these servers.
But I wonder,
with RIM, they can say, we want access to your central BIS server for all your consumers, and we want access to the BBM server.
Well, and it's good and that RIM, I mean, the good thing about in this is that even if RIM did cave a little bit, they didn't cave all the way. And they did not give them access to those centralized servers, which would have comprised a lot more data than just the people who are using those phones inside those countries. I mean, it may be that this is just going to mark a sea change for RIM, that they can't necessarily operate in such a, I guess, kind of a cloud way, that they are going to have to be willing to operate more local servers. But it makes me wonder what, because this ban applied to foreign travelers as well, and it makes me wonder what, you know, the global business marketplace is going to have to say. Are they going to say, I actually don't want to use my BlackBerry in Saudi Arabia now because they can monitor my data.
And this is the thing, which is why didn't RIM say from the beginning, oh, well, we could set up a server in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Why did they dig their heels in? I mean, you're right, Neelai. This is what got them in trouble. The fact that they run a centralized server. I mean, we've seen the same thing with P2P services. You run a centralized server, you become responsible for all that data, and you have to answer for it. When it looks like the answer here was to take one of those servers and put it in the country. Why didn't they come out with that at first?
Maybe it was a cost thing. They didn't want to incur the cost of having a server and maintain it in apparently this country. And sorry, maybe they have to put a server in each of them to have them independent and, you know, not have the Saudi government spying on the UAE server. They're going to have one server in each country. And then they were thinking, man, if every country is going to start demanding that they have specific infrastructure for them, it's going to snowball. So,
and we're seeing that.
And also, I mean, you know, security is a, you know, RIM is very proud of how secure BlackBerries are, and for good reason, right? And so as soon as they start chipping away at that armor and saying, well, your BlackBerry is end-to-end secure in the United States, but as you travel throughout the world, you know, different people can look at your traffic, you know, that really takes away from sort of the bulletproof BlackBerry image. And I can see what, you know, and RIM is a very conservative and very slow-moving company when it comes to things like that. You know, it's funny to me that, for example, the BlackBerry is you know, renowned as the best phone to do email on still to this day, right? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't do IMAP, like, which is bonkers, right? I mean, the best email phone in the world doesn't use support the world's most widely used email standard. Why? Because they want you to go through BlackBerry Internet Server and get that experience because they're very proud of it and they think it is a better experience. I don't think they want to start chipping away at what they consider their foundational strengths. And one of those foundational strengths is security.
Well, they didn't want to, but now they have. I mean, I think that it's true that they were holding out as much as they could, but now they have, and it's a slippery slope, and it's going to be interesting.
And now Kuwait has said they want RIM to block pornographic websites, and we know the United Arab Emirates still wants blocking, and Lebanon has spoken up and said that they are going to consider this. So there's a snowball effect that's happening, which is going to make BlackBerry seem like the least secure, and that's what you're pointing out here. Is there a more secure alternative to BlackBerry, given all of this?
Well, you can't go to Apple and say, we want the iPhone to block pornographic websites in Kuwait. You have to go to the carrier, right? And that makes sense. So, you know, there's no uproar when we hear about Kuwait's national carrier blocking websites or snooping on traffic.
Well, it's a smaller uproar anyway. Yeah, exactly. Because people that's Kuwait.
Edelsat in Saudi Arabia snooping on traffic on the iPhone because we know it's happening because it's not on the device. With RIM and with BlackBerry, there's that server, and it's the focal point for everyone. Because now RIM is operating the service, and they can do things to their users.
It's very clever.
And because that server exists, I mean, it's a structural issue for them.
So what happened in the past week that all of a sudden made everyone absolutely need to look into the BlackBerry messages?
I think RIM caved.
Well, it started with the Emirates asking for or kind of throwing down the gauntlet, mm-hmm. saying we're going to block this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Because BlackBerry has been operating everywhere for a long while. Why did today, all of a sudden they needed to look at everything?
Right. Maybe they just figured it out. Maybe it was some grand strategy to realize, hey, you know, if we could get local servers. I mean, it might have been just a problem that they just now got around to, or they just thought of the solution. I mean, it seems very clever. In some ways, it's sort of a coordinated attack on, as Nilay put it, the BlackBerry infrastructure, the basic fundamental operation of BlackBerry. Yeah. And now there's a huge hole in the side of that ship.
Maybe the Arab countries are investing in Apple and they want to sink RIM.
Right. I wouldn't say that Apple is the most secure way to do a phone call, though.
Yeah, no, not necessarily. Patrick, you're the king of conspiracy. I love it.
The iPhone is absolutely the most secure way to make a phone call because if you think somebody's listening on you, you just hold it wrong, you drop the call.
I was wondering where you were going.
I know, me too. I was like, what?
I think it's a snowball thing. Again, this has been going on in India for 2 years, right? The Indian government saying, we want BlackBerry servers or the ability to look at BlackBerry BBM traffic in particular. We think criminals are using it. We want to be able to get in there and look at what they're doing. BlackBerry saying no. India saying we have a deadline. BlackBerry saying, well, you're also the world's largest democracy and nothing happens on time. And India being like, turns out you're right, over and over and over again. And I think it's different when, Saudi Arabia says our royal family wants to shut down BlackBerry and here's our country and we just do whatever we want.
Yeah, and we're doing it on Friday. I mean, Saudi Arabia said we're doing it on Friday and they said that on a Wednesday. There's kind of no, and all of a sudden you've got the Secretary of State involved. You've got people talking about how this is a, you know, trade issue.
It's a very small area. It's with three kingdoms, right? And when they want to do things, they are done. And I think that's the difference here. This has been going on in that region for a long time, right? Throughout India, Pakistan, through the rest of the Middle East. And I think it just finally just happened. I think that the wheels fell off the cart for RIM, mm-hmm. and their bluff got called really hard. And all of those countries, I think, have been interested in this for a long time. A
bunch of folks in the chat room are pointing out, too, that the popular theory of why it came up now was the investigation into the alleged Mossad assassination attempt, and that said that those guys were using BlackBerries, and in the course of the investigation, they couldn't get some of the data they wanted to investigate the assassinations, and that's what started this turning against RIM, saying, well, fine, we can't allow this to happen again. We need to be able to get this kind of information in the future. But India has spoken back up again since this came up and said, we're still on this.
And, Lebanon has joined too. Yeah. I mean, it's going to snowball. There's no question. And good question, Patrick. I mean, way to get to the heart of the question or the matter, which is like, why is it now?
And didn't BlackBerry have issues? I mean, RIM have issues with Russia about this a while ago?
Yeah. And they solved it by putting a server in Russia as far as I know.
So shocking news.
Yeah. So it was not a big surprise that they were going to have to end up putting a server in the country. It's just that they were so vociferously insisting they couldn't earlier this week.
We did it in Russia, but they have machine guns.
Yeah,
exactly.
Shall we net neutrality?
We shall in a moment, because first we have to thank our sponsor, Squarespace, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. I didn't transition into it. I just transitioned.
I ruined it. It was my fault.
It was a perfect transition. Doesn't have to be like, you know, directly connected. But thanks for pointing out that it was a bad transition, Patrick.
I love Squarespace.
We'll put a
They're
server
awesome.
In your house to run your
That's
blog.
That's right. Actually, it's kind of like that. Squarespace is a dedicated server for running your blog. So it's got an easy-to-use UI, optimized for beginners and CSS experts. You don't have to know a thing, but if you do, you can still take control of your blog. Hundreds of design templates, lots of modules. You can add forums and photo galleries and form builders, collect email addresses from people. If you don't want to put your email address out there, you want to actually have people email you without knowing your address, you can build a form, all plug-and-play stuff. Website tracking, too, to let people to find out who's visiting your site and how well it's going. All of that done on their servers, so you don't have to mess with it. You get too many people, they upgrade the service. They adapt. They're flexible. So why not try it out for free? You don't need a credit card. You just go to squarespace.com/twit. Import your website. They have importer tools for Blogger, for WordPress, for Typepad, and just give it a whirl. See if you like it. If you do and you decide to purchase it, you get 10% off when you enter the offer code TWIT. That's squarespace.com/TWIT. Now let's talk a little net neutrality, perhaps a Squarespace blog for protesting net neutrality or supporting net neutrality. It's the transition on the other end for Patrick.
Or explaining what in the hell is going on with this Google Verizon story.
Right. So this one has been, we've had a lot of thorny, like unusual stories. Usually August is dead for tech news, but this week, thankfully, since I had to do Twit this week, was full of really deep, rich stories. Earlier this week, it broke that Google and Verizon had created a secret way to settle net neutrality. So depending on who you read, it worked in different ways. Bloomberg was saying that wireline service from Verizon would continue to be net neutral, but wireless service would be able to be managed in whatever way Verizon saw fit. This was an agreement between Google and Verizon. New York Times reported that Google had agreed that Verizon could charge for certain priority access, which would be considered a violation of net neutrality on wireline or wireless. And then Eric Schmidt came out and said, you know, what would be okay, and he wasn't commenting specifically on this story, but he said what would be okay is if you said all video could be prioritized over email. Mm-hmm. It's just quality of service management. So we're not saying that a particular video service like YouTube would be prioritized, but video prioritized over email, he would be fine with that. Then, as Google and Verizon were denying this, saying New York Times got it wrong, everything is wrong about this story, the FCC popped in and said, hey, by the way, the talks we've been having with not only Google and Verizon, but a ton of other stakeholders in the area, including nonprofit groups, they're off. We're done. We're done. We're pulling out of this.
They're failing.
Yeah.
So letting Google and Verizon work this out
a little bit, because, you know, this is a FCC regulation is thorny and complicated. And a lot of these stories conflated issues and got things wrong in ways that just suggest to me that they weren't all the facts weren't there.
Well,
so
I think
the idea
clearly.
That wireline services would remain net neutral is very strange, right? Because traditionally when we talk about Verizon's wireline services, we are talking about their phone services. And those services are already neutral. They've been neutral for decades, right? You can plug in whatever phone you want. What they're talking about is like Verizon DSL, right? And Verizon Fios. That's actually really important. That's part of the heart of the net neutrality debate. And Verizon and Google, they don't have the ability to agree that they'll remain neutral. That doesn't make any sense. Unless, you know, the trade is you know, Verizon, you know, we're Google. We really want your network to be neutral. We know that you don't. What we'll do is we'll trade you. So if you agree to leave Fios open to everybody, we will pay you to have YouTube be faster on Verizon Wireless.
And I think that's exactly fine. What's happening here. And I think that I suspect my theory is that's exactly the deal they're making. But I think it's not going to be fine in the future, because I think it is very clear that whatever deal is made between Google and Verizon will be the deal that affects future legislation and future regulation, because the FCC has basically said, on the one hand, we now, according to the courts, don't have the authority to regulate this. We're backing away from re-regulation, and we're throwing up our hands. We're saying, you guys work it out, and we'll follow your lead.
But this is what's really strange to me about this, is because the FCC isn't backing away. Their new plan is much more aggressive than their old plan. And the old plan is what the court said was they didn't have the authority to do.
Yeah.
So,
but the new plan, I think they're almost certainly going to abandon, because they've encountered so much more resistance than they expected to that sort of third way reclassification.
And the new plan would be the reclassification as Title I service or Title II?
Title II
service, which means you're back to being governed as a more like a phone company than this new service, which is more like a cable company.
Yeah.
Right, but the administration, our current, you know, the Obama administration is very supportive of net neutrality. The reclassification is the only way that the FCC can act under the scope of their current powers. And they do, in fact, have the ability to re-regulate like that. I mean, it's what they're empowered to do.
They can say, we're changing the service
from this to this.
But Congress was up in arms. I mean, Republicans, Democrats, they encountered a ton of resistance to re-regulation that I think they really weren't expecting. I mean, they were, you know, senators, House representatives, all kinds of groups that you would otherwise, even Google, which you would think might be in favor, was pretty tepid on the idea of re-regulation. I don't think the FCC has the support for that they were hoping they would have. And I feel like they'll probably back away. And they're hoping that the marketplace in the form of these kind of backroom deals between maybe Google and Verizon will figure it out. But what I think is that wireless is going to be abandoned in terms of the next battleground. Wireless is going to be left to be tiered, you know, to hell and back.
Can I say this story scares the bejesus out of me? Seriously, I've been hearing. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was French.
Yes, exactly. but I've been hearing more and more people going from, you know, net neutrality is important, and it's one of the founding principles of the internet, and it's really important not to abandon it, to, with this story, all of a sudden, first of all, Google being sort of, we don't really know what they've been talking about, and then, well, maybe if it's, you know, only for certain general types of files and you don't discriminate the specific company, or if it's only for wireless, then it's okay. I think Cooley was saying, well, maybe the business could figure it out. And, you know, free hand of the market will do something perfect with all of this. How can people, I'm sorry, I'm going into a little bit of a rant here, but how can people all of a sudden be abandoning net neutrality like this? It's horrendous. The idea that we can start with maybe wireless and maybe video and maybe, no, this, we cannot go down that road. And this is one of the places where we absolutely, absolutely need regulation. We don't need the FCC to get hands off and to start saying, well, we're not going to be talking about it. And we don't need tech journalists to start thinking maybe businesses are going to be taking care of this, because whatever we decide on now is going to be the foundation for what happens later. And we don't know what we're going to need later. The internet evolves so fast because we have no restrictions and we get innovation. I mean, you all know that, but I was terrified at the reaction to the story. And I'm certainly very happy that you guys here seem to be saying that, you know, maybe we should actually protect it and fight for it.
I was quite confused by this entire story until I read Schmidt's quote. And then I realized that fits in where I have been uncomfortable with net neutrality is the idea that we take away management tools from network administrators. Like, you can write net neutrality laws in a way that would really be bad for the internet and would be bad for bandwidth. And so what Schmidt seemed to be saying was quality of service, where we don't discriminate on content, but content type. Because if your email gets delayed by a few milliseconds, you'll never notice. But if your video gets delayed, you start to notice. And if your VoIP gets delayed, you really notice.
But he also will.
That doesn't work, Tom. That doesn't work. You start with video and you say, okay, the internet today, we need video to be delivered fast. And that's the state of the internet at, you know, in 2010. But what happens when some other sort of data transmission starts to, you know, some guy in his garage imagines that we're going to make, I don't know, BitTorrent, for example.
Then the ISP is allowed to adapt to that. It says you don't write it into the law that this is what you can prioritize, but you do say, look, you can prioritize by content type, not by content delivery.
Wait, if you start saying it's okay to...
That the FCC has put forward is the ability for network operators and ISPs to manage their networks. Mm-hmm. I don't think the FCC has ever said we want to legislate or regulate how you manage your network or how you deliver quality of service to your users. What they are saying is we don't want you to prioritize certain content from certain providers over others.
But right?
We want you to manage your network in a way that's fair. And if it's not fair, we want there to be some sort of process or litigation that will resolve the issue, right? So we want to say these are the rules. You have to be fair, and then you can do whatever you want under the rules. And if you don't do them, the aggrieved party can sue you.
The thing I think we need to watch out for, though, like you said, Patrick, in terms of the future precedent, is that wireless broadband is considered, even by the FCC, to be, you know, the savior of broadband access in America, that it's going to solve the last mile problem, that in the future, most of us will consume our data over wireless networks and not as much over wired networks. That's the new infrastructure, and it is the new battleground, and I think that Google is absolutely about to sell us down the river when it comes to tiering wireless networks, because the telcos are holding all the cards. Verizon, Sprint, AT&T can say, we're just not going to build out our wireless broadband networks. We're not going to build out that infrastructure to save you all from the coming bandwidth crunch unless we have a guarantee that we can prioritize traffic as we see fit and that we can charge for that traffic as we see fit. And Schmidt was very fuzzy on that.
I agree with you. No, Somali, I think that's incredibly poignant, and I think you got it nailed. And let me build on that, because I think Verizon and Google right now have a very close relationship with Android and what they're doing with Android. And I think Google, bring this back to the top of the show, you know, one day the iPhone is going to be on Verizon. And if Google already has a relationship to prioritize traffic to Android devices from Google services on Verizon's network in place, the Android phones will always be more attractive than the iPhone
network. And you can't trust these companies. I mean, the reason that this became an issue with Comcast and Time Warner is that they started getting into content delivery. They had a conflict of interest when it came to their competing services, because on the one hand, they were providing the pipe, but on the other hand, they were providing content that they wanted to get through the pipe more quickly. And that's why their tiering became so unnerving. The same proposition exists with the telcos, and the same proposition, like you point out, Neelai, exists with Google. They are in a position to want to prioritize not only traffic in the form of YouTube video, but traffic to specific devices in the form of Android devices. And don't think for a minute that Google is going to hold on to the vaunted net neutrality principles when it comes to increasing market share in both of those arenas.
And there's a story kicking around that those data center containers that Google has had for years and years and years might be placed near Verizon data centers, and Google would pipe directly into the Verizon network, so it would never go out on the open internet if you're in Verizon, and they would be able to subvert any net neutrality regulation anyway.
Oh.
So
this made me cry a little.
This is the reason why you have so many, you know, workarounds and loopholes and ways that the people talking in secret rooms can circumvent what the law is, that you shouldn't say, okay, you can do things in a fair way in these different sort of, you know, special cases. What you have to do to preserve the internet, people, this is important. We're not talking about YouTube and videos of cats only. The internet, in order to preserve it, you need to say you cannot prioritize anything. And managing your network is another way of saying you can do whatever the hell you want. And
I don't agree with that part of it.
Actually, there was that internet, too.
Wrong.
Remember when we first...
But there's more to the internet
no,
than
you
cats.
Are. Remember when we first started talking about net neutrality years ago, and Internet 2 was conducting all those tests, and they actually found that network management didn't have to include prioritizing certain amounts of traffic. They released that study that said, we think that if you provide sufficient bandwidth, you don't have to do QoS monitoring, and you don't have to do that kind of packet level management to ensure that data, get, you know, video travels better or voice travels better.
I had this argument, that exact argument, with the network administrator at the University of Chicago my freshman year of college in 1999, saying there is sufficient bandwidth on our network. I don't know why you're shutting down Napster.
And
it turned out I was, but that conversation I've been having in one form or another since I was a freshman in college.
And
I think it's exactly right. You know, if there's enough bandwidth, you can just do whatever you want. The issue is that wireless networks don't have enough bandwidth. And the reality is we need to allow those operators to manage their networks. It's the balance that I think right now we're seeing the pendulum swing wildly between two extremes. The FCC says you're a Title II service. We're going to regulate you like the traditional landline telephones. Everybody has to be neutral. And then, you know, there's some pushback. And then the pendulum swings wildly to Google and Verizon, making a deal in secret in the back room. And we just need, you know, the oscillation has to stop at some point.
Yeah, the problem is we actually don't know what that agreement was. We only know what it wasn't. Right. Google and Verizon very specifically said, no, we did not come to any kind of agreement about allowing prioritization of Verizon or Google content on the internet. They specifically came out on that, which is unusual in these situations. Mm-hmm. Usually you get sort of some kind of vague, plausible, non-denial denial. So we know that wasn't part of it, but we don't know what they did agree on, if they agreed on anything.
And we also know that the stories, the Bloomberg, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times stories are still out there and have not been corrected or amended by those outlets. I mean, that doesn't necessarily say it all, but the fact that the New York Times did not issue a correction after being flatly contradicted by Verizon and Google, I thought was also interesting. They did not say we're backing away from the story, or even issue a clarification.
So we have wired communications, not wireline, as Neil pointed out, but wired like DSL and Fios on the one hand, and the idea of whether we need quality of service management on that or not. And then we have wireless communication, which, even though we've been talking about it in relations to quality of service, everything we've talked about has said, well, wireless, no net neutrality.
Yep.
Up for grabs. And Molly pointed out, that's where it gets really scary. And what I would like to add to that is, what's really interesting is wireless, the FCC can regulate a lot more easily than wired, because it's a scarce resource that is managed by the FCC. It's one of the reasons the FCC exists, is to manage that spectrum that wireless exists in. So is it because the FCC just thinks we'll get to that later?
I think the FCC is this is what I said on Buzz Out Loud. I think they're pretty neutered. I mean, I think they are backing away a little bit from reclassification. I think that they've been gutted by that Comcast ruling, and I think they don't have the administrative and congressional support that they thought they would have for exerting those regulations, because there's such an intense, you know, when net neutrality became a partisan issue, it became a lot harder for the FCC to say, this is about managing a crucial resource for America, which is what they were trying to say with the broadband plan, but they were undercut at almost every turn.
Go ahead, Neil.
I really agreed with their Title II reclassification. I thought that their proposal that the FCC put out and the way they wanted to do it made a lot of sense, right? Mm-hmm. Because the best way to do something administratively and politically is to utilize the power that you already have. And to go out and try to seek new power is always a bad idea, because somebody will challenge your ability to have that authority. For the FCC to say, well, here's the authority that we have. We're going to organize a way to use it as responsibly as possible, and we're going to do what we're tasked to do, made a lot of sense to me. And, you know, it didn't matter what they said, right? They could have said anything. They could have said, you know, we're going to go back to Congress and ask for a bill giving a specific authority to regulate the internet in a net neutral way. And they still would have gotten pushback from the industry. And I think it's the vociferous lobbying from the ISPs and from the carriers that's pushing them back. It doesn't matter how they try to do it.
Right.
I think that's really the problem that the FCC is going to have to solve. They really need to get some political capital, and they really need to find a way to sell their side of the story in a way that, you know, once you've got Google and Verizon signing a deal in the back room, or even talking about it, once you've lost Google as a proponent of net neutrality, you've really lost a lot. I mean, I think they need to start rounding up university support, I think research support, all this other stuff that they need to do, because they don't have the political capital to push net neutrality through right now. And that's scary, you know.
I really thought
that their Title II reclassification was a good plan, and it, you know, Molly, I'm more of an optimist than you.
I hope so.
Stupid.
I mean, I hope you're right. You know, I wrote the most depressing column this week that I've ever written. I wrote net neutrality is dead on wireless networks as a Molly rant, because it was, you know, it seemed to me that the tone of all of this was Google and Verizon are cutting a deal to exempt wireless networks from net neutrality, and it is going to influence future policy.
Well, just one wireless network.
Well, that's the thing, Bill Molly.
Yeah, but that's how it starts.
Well, no, it's a good point, though, because we actually have competition.
We should defend it to the death.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah.
We actually have more competition in wireless networks than we have in wired, at least for the moment.
For the moment.
We'll see if that lasts.
You know, we don't have that issue in wireless networks in France. They're working fine, and we're getting video and everything. The solution is not to restrict the amount. Because if you give them the power to restrict the way the data is funneled, then they're never going to expand. They're always going to say, well, you know, our network is too small, and we can't handle that kind of bandwidth.
But they're not going to expand without it either. I think that they are saying, I think what they're saying right now is there is no way in hell that we are going to build out our mobile broadband infrastructures subject to the same restrictions that the wired carriers have had to deal with. And no way are we going to be neutered like that.
Aren't they? They're building 4G. They're already doing it.
I think they are building for sure, but they want to make sure that they are in control before they're willing to say we don't have the network scarcity, that, you know, because right now they're falling
free
back
market.
On network scarcity.
It's free market. Once one of them has a proper 4G network, the other ones are going to have to follow. It's competition.
I love that the Frenchman's defending the free market. It brings a tear to my eye.
I know. I wish I believed that actually worked as much as you believe. Wow. This is upside-down bizarro world.
They are doing it. Who is it who has a 4G network? It's Sprint, isn't it?
Yes. Sprint has a small
Sprint
one now, yes.
With the Clearwire partnership has a WiMAX 4G network.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right. But
it's something.
You know, barely counts.
Better than nothing.
I talk about competition on wireless networks all the time because, you know, this is an age-old battle between people who have an access layer and a content layer, right? And it's like everybody who's sort of like us, the nerds of the world, they know that what you really want is a dumb pipe. And that's all that anybody should really want, right? Mm-hmm. And there should be competition between different dumb pipes over who is the fastest and most reliable. The problem is that it's like they're arrogant or they're pretentious or something, and they believe that they should be more than dumb pipes. So Verizon wants to run an app store and have a media service and all this other stuff to differentiate their dumb pipe. And it's like they don't realize that the best differentiation for their service would be being faster and more reliable, potentially at a cheaper price. And if they competed on those metrics, I think we'd all be better off.
If we had more choices, they would be competing on those metrics. But the problem is most people have but two choices, sometimes only one.
Right.
No, and it may be the case. And we do, in fact, have more competition among wireless carriers than we do among wired. But even that isn't saying much because the iPhone is still not available in two of the three states that I lived in most recently because they don't have 3G there.
Right, and the Motorola Droid isn't available on AT&T. And when you do sign up for one of these phones, you sign a 2-year contract.
Exactly.
So the subscriber base isn't mobile, and you know it's not.
So you guys,
not liquid.
You guys know what the solution is, right? I'm going to go back to my socialist French self here, and I'm going to make Tom happy. You need a government mandated wireless network covering the whole country that provides the minimum service, so that
Tom's like, no,
that does not make me happy.
No.
Now you are talking crazy, my friend.
Well, that was part. I mean, that was part of the hope of the National Broadband Plan, that they would actually be able to mandate to enact actual competition via a variety of methods, and one of them just being simple metrics. You know, finding out what was available where and at what cost, and really bringing transparency into the debate. And then hopefully, you know, freeing up spectrum, and they had all of these steps that were hopefully going to increase competition. But now they have just backed off. I feel like they've thrown up their hands and they've said, you know what, you guys work it out. We're just going to be over here. We're tired.
So why does that not make you happy, Tom? What's the problem in that idea?
Because
your situation now is so much better.
No, because because our wireless situation is the one hope. Because you can have a choice of five or six different providers instead of one or two. And then you can have a free market work where people say, you know what, actually, I'm going to choose Sprint. I'm going to choose Metro PCS. I'm going to choose somebody else because I don't like the restrictions I'm getting. And you don't have to have anybody come in and put a regulatory hand on it. I think there's a better chance of that working.
that is never going to work, especially in wireless, because when you're taking a wireless service, you expect it to work in different parts of the country. And if you have segmented different little providers, they're not going to be working everywhere, or they're going to be more expensive. I mean, wireless network is not working now. What you're saying is it could be working in the future if it was done properly. And, you know, if things were done properly, BP wouldn't have spilled millions of gallons of oil in the Mexican
slippery slope.
Drink.
I call some derivation of Godwin's law involving oil.
Totally.
Damn it.
You cannot go BP on us. You cannot go there.
Damn it.
Trains run on time. You know, it's not going to matter because a huge ice sheet just broke off from Greenland and it's coming after us and we're all going to be eaten by a monster glacier.
Yeah, my version of Godwin's law now is just 2012.
Yeah.
You know what? Yeah, I'm pretty worried about that. 2012.
You heard about that. The largest Arctic iceberg since 1962.
Yeah. It's a little scary out there.
I'm saying theme park.
Ooh, well, fun. Sledding galore.
Floating theme park.
If they could deal with it in 1962, it's not like, you know, it was so long ago. It can't have been that bad. We would have heard about it. It would have been a movie about it.
They all just went out and poured Lucky Strikes and whiskey on it back then. Melted the dang thing.
Lucky Strikes.
We don't have that kind of
flamethrowers.
Chutzpah anymore.
Oof,
all right, since we're talking about something ecological, let's talk about Ford, makers of the Ford EcoBoost engine. Also a sponsor on Twit. It's a 3.5-liter twin-turbocharged 365-horsepower V6 direct injection to increase fuel efficiency. Ford has brought both the twin turbos and direct injection together in the EcoBoost to deliver the performance of a much larger engine with the fuel economy of a smaller engine. It's the first engine of its kind in North America, the first twin turbocharged direct injection V6 in North America. And EcoBoost is standard on the new 2011 Taurus Show, the Taurus SHO. It has an EPA estimated fuel economy of 17 in the city, 25 on the highway, and the Taurus Show and most of the Ford cars also feature voice-activated sync, the in-car connectivity system that gives you true hands-free calling, turn-by-turn voice directions without having to purchase additional hardware, 911 assist, voice-activated music and podcasting, your text messages read aloud so you can keep connected while keeping your eyes on the road and your hands on the wheel, and so much more in voice-activated sync. You can check out both the Ford EcoBoost engine and sync by driving the Taurus Show, the Taurus SHO, at a Ford dealer near you. Stop by a Ford dealer this week and drive one. All right. This just broke, actually. A Best Buy has had privileged status as the only iPod seller, according to the New York Times. But Robert Stevens, CTO and founder of its Geek Squad service, posted a couple prototype tablet photos on Twitter this week out of nowhere. It's just an empty shell, but he says it carries Best Buy's Rocketfish brand, and it looks like Best Buy is going to have their own tablet.
What? Really? Oh, like an Insignia version. Interesting.
It looks, according to this New York Times story, a little like an HP Slate.
Dishy.
Do you think that's what they did with them?
We have this hardware and we don't really know what to do with it anymore. That would be interesting. It wouldn't be surprising, I guess, if they did an Insignia tablet. Although, as with all tablet discussions, just call me when there are some.
Yeah, right.
Seriously, where are all of the iPad competitors? They're all in development and coming Q4. So either we're all going to be buried under them in Q4, or we're just all going to...
There was the one that sold out at Kmart, $150 tablet, Android tablet. So we actually saw one.
Actually, people seem to like the Dell Streak, too, much to my surprise.
The Streak has got a lot of hype.
It seems kind of popular. Yeah. All right, you go, Best Buy. You make your Insignia. Really, at this point, anybody.
Somebody.
Just make a damn tablet. I am ready.
Where's the juju?
Oh, God. We had two separate jujus come into CNET, and both of them failed. Just died.
Both of them.
Wouldn't even turn on.
Wow.
Yeah. You had two at CNET?
Yeah,
review. And you had like 10% of the whole production run?
I think it was like more like 15%. But yeah. Poor juju.
WikiLeaks this week came under fire from the Pentagon, who minced no words in telling them they did not have any conversations. They did not have permission, and they asked them to return the classified documents.
We want our stuff back.
Which most people have been, even Boing have been very kindly posting as delete, even though he used the words return the documents, because we're assuming the Pentagon knows that they aren't in a pouch.
I don't know if they know. No, but I think they think an envelope is headed their way.
They're digitized.
As much as the net neutrality story scares me, this one makes me equally laugh. And it's extremely cute. I love it. Please return the files.
Can you give that back? Because they actually, they said, I think, in the letter that they sent WikiLeaks, they said delete and return.
Yeah.
So well, maybe they're still trafficking in paper.
Jeff Morrell, the department's press secretary, demands that WikiLeaks return immediately to the U.S. government all versions of documents obtained directly or indirectly from the Department of Defense. You know, to give them their credit, they may be meaning the original media upon which you got this.
Yeah,
whether it's an email or a USB drive or something so that they could do forensic analysis on it and try to trace where it came from. Because that's what they're up to, is they're trying to find out how WikiLeaks got this stuff, as well as asking them to take it down. They've also banned the military from viewing WikiLeaks, which a lot of people have pointed out means that the terrorists can see WikiLeaks, but the military can't.
I think that's kind of silly.
And they've also
but our servicemen don't need to be looking at WikiLeaks.
I
think the people who are doing intelligence probably still had access
and are probably not banned.
And the military has a leveling system about classification and need to know and knowledge sharing. And I think that it is perfectly reasonable for them to want to protect the classified structure by saying, look, you don't need to be reading WikiLeaks and finding out information that's above your pay grade. I mean, that's just how the military works.
Although the opposite side of that is that I can read it, but someone in the military can't. So it's almost a false ban. I mean, there's an easy way to get around it. The cat's out of the bag there.
Yeah, true.
Of course it is. Barn. But it's a very cheap shot of saying, you know, the terrorists can look at it and the military can't. It's very cheap. I mean, of course they're going to say, you guys shouldn't be looking at it, but who knows what's going to happen. But they should still issue the order of, you should look at it, and it's above your secret level thing.
They probably shouldn't just be surfing the web at work. It's probably more. It's more like a Facebook ban in that way when you think about it.
Well, and then now there's this odd file that WikiLeaks has posted, a mysterious encrypted file labeled insurance. Should something happen to us, open this file. Dun, dun, dun. And apparently it's huge.
Yeah, it's a 1.4 gigabyte file with AES 256 encryption. Mm-hmm. And lots of people have downloaded it. Nobody can crack into it with that kind of encryption. Yeah. Not easily. Not really at all.
It'll be a while.
But everyone suspects that, you know, if something should go down wrong or Julian Assange should come up, you know, face up in the Hudson, that keys would be released for people to unlock this file. And my guess is it's everything else that they've gotten regarding Afghanistan, because they've said there's lots of documents that they have received that they have not posted because they felt they were dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. This is super scary. I mean, this whole WikiLeaks, I've always been extremely supportive of WikiLeaks in general, but I have to say this story made me think, all right, wait a second, because these files, I mean, the insurance thing aside, the whole military correspondence for the war in Afghanistan, I'm like, maybe there should be somewhat a way to control that. Or maybe, I don't know, it just makes me question a little bit WikiLeaks. And I know it's a very important service to have. It's a very important site. But it's like putting light on how disruptive it can become. It's almost an anarchy device, kind of.
I mean, I think the question is really, it sort of feels like dogma is bad on either side, right? On the military side, they're too secretive. There's no question that the dogma of secrecy at all costs is dangerous, but openness at all costs may be equally dangerous. And I think that's what we're finding out. It's not, is it worth it? Should there be some secrets that save people's lives, for God's sake, you know, and is it worth it to protect those?
Yeah. You know, I don't want to get too crazy and philosophical here, but I've noticed recently that the sort of the culture of the internet, if you will, and the narrative that sort of the right wing media in particular spins is that authority is not to be trusted, and that systems and government have failed, right? And that, you know, sort of general anarchy, like Patrick is saying, is sort of the way to go, right? That, you know, government can't be trusted because it doesn't function, and authority can't be trusted because it lies to you. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like WikiLeaks is absolutely, I think, a paragon of this attitude, where they say, well, you can trust us, but we don't know, you know, we don't have authority. We're anti-authority. Mm-hmm. And by being anti-authority, that's how we gain your trust. But the fact of the matter is that WikiLeaks, just like our government and our military and every other institution, is run by people. And people have biases and opinions, and they will selectively try to make you agree with them and persuade you. And that's really the problem with WikiLeaks, is that they release information in a way that suits them, and they don't release all the information and let everybody decide. And so, I mean, that's my issue with WikiLeaks in general, is that they've put themselves in this position of saying, you know, the government isn't to be trusted. They're not telling you everything. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they very actively don't tell you everything.
You should be in life and in politics and on the internet, you should be very suspicious of anyone who says, I'm right. I am the one who's right. Because that is almost never true. You know,
unless it's coming from me or Molly.
Yeah, mainly if it's
damn
me.
Damn it, you stole my joke.
But, it's just a very good lesson. It's that WikiLeaks is no less a true believer than anybody else. They think that what they are doing is the only right way to go, and they will not be persuaded by logic or safety concerns or anything. And any time I think that your position is that extreme, you're just going to cause trouble.
Right. And the thing, particularly with government, and maybe this is going to sound crazy coming from me, but.
Wait, that's not going to sound crazy because we lost your audio.
No, totally. It was going to sound, it was so crazy.
It was too crazy. The government wouldn't allow it out.
You self-muted.
No. So particularly in the case of government, and I think this is going to sound odd for me because I'm not some crazy supporter of institutionalized government, but government, in America, you can get rid of, right? If the government does something wrong, the system is designed so that you can vote the bastards out, right? You don't get to vote out WikiLeaks. Like, you don't, they continue to be there. And if they do something wrong, they're still there and they don't go away. And so it's odd to me whenever we see private institutions come down and, really demand that we take down the government in some way, the way that WikiLeaks does, because there's a check for the people in the government. There's not a check on WikiLeaks. And I think that's sort of an interesting dynamic that they've really used to their advantage by saying we're the ones who are right, and your government is not to be trusted.
Well, you point out an interesting fact here that WikiLeaks is taking advantage of, which is the infinite copyability of the internet, right? Where if it was just a marketplace of ideas and people got to shout them forth, some voices would be heard more than others, and you'd be able to discern which one you want. But on the internet, when you're talking about leaks, it takes one posting, and so they have so much more power than the government in that way, which has to fight to stay elected. And it's why you see so much crap in the rhetoric and so much ridiculous, slippery slopes and all this thing to try to trick people into voting for them. Whereas all WikiLeaks has to do to affect their agenda is post once. Mm-hmm. And then it is infinitely copyable from then on.
And because they're really good at what they do, the narrative that they provide about the information that they leak is generally the dominant narrative until it's corrected, but nobody cares about corrections, right? So to bring this back to sort of two subjects that I'm more familiar with and feel more comfortable talking about is an example of this phenomenon. One is, for example, the iPhone 4 antenna, where everybody who sees my iPhone 4 to this day says, oh, do you drop calls when you hold it wrong? And the answer is no, right? Because you don't drop calls when you hold it wrong. You lose some signal. And that might, it's like there's this whole other explanation now. But the media narrative has been you drop calls and you hold it wrong. And so that's out there. It's forever. And Apple can't do anything to fix it. Another one from just this week was Apple used some images in a patent application of a third-party application, like an iPhone app. They used a screenshot in their patent apps. And the narrative immediately was Apple's trying to patent iPhone apps that other developers have submitted to the App Store. And it's like, well, no, that's absolutely not true. And I'll explain it to you. But, it took me a day to put up that explanation, and then it was over. It was like, it was one of those things where I was writing it, and I was like, I know this doesn't matter, but I want the right information to be out there. And it's like those narratives take hold so quickly, and especially because information, like you're saying, can be repeated so often and so quickly as soon as it's out there. It's almost as though they have, an exponential amount more power over the media narrative than the government. Because the government's going to come in and, quite frankly, be boring, right? They're going to be like, well, that isn't actually the case. We're not murdering civilians. Here is this exercise and blah, blah, blah. And nobody cares.
Well, the government's going to say it's not as black and white as you have portrayed it, WikiLeaks. It's more nuanced and it's more complicated, and no one likes to listen to that.
And the WikiLeaks side of the argument is if you want to be able to make a good judgment on government and find out who the bastards are who you want to throw out, you need all the information. They're not going to give it to you. We will. we will pass it along unfiltered. Mm-hmm. You know,
which
they
also
don't.
Doesn't necessarily help.
They do filter it. But, you know, I think there is a good purpose behind something like WikiLeaks to say, hey, we want to get information out there that you need to know to understand how things work in your country. But it has to be done responsibly. And I think that's the conversation we're having here is WikiLeaks responsible?
So
and
me,
should we trust them?
Well, I think go ahead.
I mean, just a quick thing is what you're saying is WikiLeaks needs to be more responsible. So they need to take in all of this information that they're getting, filter it out, and explain what the government is doing. That role is the role of the press.
Well, and they did that. That's what's interesting is they passed that along to three news outlets, Der Spiegel, the Guardian, mm-hmm. right, and the New York Times, to do that for them. Then they said, but we also want you to have the source information. We want you to have the source material so you can double check the press.
Yeah, this is not the WikiLeaks is not supposed to be the press. WikiLeaks serves a different purpose. It's a place to post information anonymously, whatever that information may be. And what we're seeing now, I believe, what we're realizing, it's sort of a wake-up call. We're realizing maybe this sort of no accountability possibility that we have now with the internet, with, I would say, WikiLeaks, but other venues like maybe 4chan even, which no one can touch, and you know it's sort of scary almost, is that too much non-accountability? And we obviously can't do anything about it at this point, I don't think, because if you strike down WikiLeaks, for example, something else will come up somewhere else. But it is sort of awe-inspiring and a little bit too much maybe. And that's what we're realizing now. It's not the fact that WikiLeaks should edit or shouldn't edit the information they're putting out. It's the fact that you can put out this information with, and once it's out of the bag, it's finished. That's the problem. And is it really a big problem is the question we should answer.
But I think that's the issue, right? So every single day at Engadget, we get tips on new products or services, or we get people send us in fake spy shots, all this stuff, right? And our readers rely on us to filter out the wheat from the chaff. And sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. Sometimes we miss things. But we have a good record and our credibility is based on that record, and we work very hard to maintain it. And I think what WikiLeaks does is they don't filter. And the way that they do filter is with these selective edits and these selective releases and this sort of aura of sort of anti-authority rebellion. And as soon as something is on WikiLeaks with all of that sort of branding, and I don't want to call it branding, but that reputation behind it, mm-hmm. it gains some status. And so this goal of, you know, you can just submit information for the commons to decide if it's true or valid or important goes away as soon as WikiLeaks starts performing editorial functions, like editing video and releasing it to news outlets, like saying, here's what we think is important, like saying the government isn't telling you the whole truth. Because as soon as they start performing that editorial function, everything else on their site becomes part of it. And I think that's the danger. If WikiLeaks was just a repository and you could go to it and there was some information on there, and you could take away and other people could form narratives from it, well, that would be different. But they're very much performing an editorial role as well.
Well, let's finish up with a story that is sort of the opposite. It's someone who wanted to keep something secret in order to save society. That is 45-year-old Terry Childs, former sysadmin for the city of San Francisco, who received his sentencing this weekend, actually on Friday. 4 years in prison for refusing to hand over administrative passwords to the city's FiberWAN network back in July 2008. A judge convicted Childs in April of violating state hacking laws. Childs says that his bosses were incompetent, and he would only give the passwords to the mayor after he had explained why his bosses were incompetent and couldn't be trusted with the system. But he has finally received his sentence, and he'll spend 4 years in jail for defending his principles very assiduously.
Yeah.
this is a story that Molly and I were following back in Buzz Out Loud when we were on there together. And it just there's something entertaining about a guy who, you know, whatever you think the facts of the case are, said, yeah, I'll go to jail.
Right.
I don't think my bosses know what they're doing. I think they're endangering the city, and I will only give this password to the mayor.
Talk about an unswerving belief in your own rightness. This guy is like the poster boy for that particular behavior. And I cannot... I mean, 4 years in jail, that's some serious business.
It's ridiculous. I think there's also a sort of sense of satisfaction for every single one of us who's been in that situation where you know that the guy who's managing stuff is incompetent and shouldn't be trusted with the information you have. And you wanted to, you know, not give it to him or not make him able to manage whatever he should be managing. And he's actually going and doing it and going to jail for this. I think we should open a fund for this guy and just, you know, make him rich after he comes out.
I don't know. He sounds like kind of a jerk. Let's not go that far. I mean,
well,
like I said, the unswerving belief
on the internet.
Yeah, maybe he could have his own day.
We should point out that during the 12 days that he would not return over the administrative passwords, the network ran fine. It never went down. Nothing bad ever happened. But the prosecutors characterized him as power hungry and sort of a control freak.
Yeah.
You think?
But I do.
So
I think
he's doing time.
I think the 4 years is, that's a pretty astonishingly harsh sentence, I got to say. I think he really pissed them off is what happened there.
Yeah, I have to imagine this trial was just amazing.
It was hilarious. We could not get enough of this story on Buzz Out Loud. I mean, we were like, I know it's local, but people, this is amazing. I demand to see the mayor. He has to come to my jail cell like he's Hannibal Lecter.
I will not give the password to anyone else.
Anyone
and you know
else.
What? The mayor came to his jail cell because he had him by the balls. They couldn't do anything without him.
What if they're making an example of him right now?
Yeah.
What if the network was actually in danger because of these incompetent people? I mean, I'm sure it's not the case, but you know, what if he was actually fighting for something right? Maybe? No?
Well, he's willing to risk it. In case he is, yeah, because there's always, I mean, how do you prove that in court?
Right.
You know, I mean, that's a difficult one.
And he was probably saying, I won't argue in court because you are incompetent.
Yeah, every villain is the hero of his own story.
Yeah, exactly.
And you that's are incompetent. True. And you are incompetent.
You are.
All right. Well, y'all, thank you very much for a very enjoyable discussion today on Twit. This is fantastic. I know we had good news to work with, but you guys were great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Us.
Thank you.
For my part, I am thrilled.
Nilay Patel, managing editor of Engadget. You can follow you on Twitter. Your Twitter name is Reckless, correct?
Indeed it is.
Why is it Reckless?
Although I'm calming down now.
Your next Twitter name is going to be calming down.
Late 20s.
Anything else you want to plug?
No, that's it. Just hitting Gadget. I mean, I think we're going to have a big week this week, so should be good.
Patrick Beja is host of Le Rendezvous Tech. You can find many of his works at frenchspin.com. You can follow him on Twitter at notpatrick, NotPatrick. Anything else going on you want to tell us about?
I guess if you like podcasts and you speak French or you're learning French, you could go to nowatch.fm where we have a number of excellent podcasts to entertain you.
Excellent. Or excellent.
If you will.
Maybe. Molly Wood at CNET.com/Molly, executive editor of CNET.com, host of Buzz Out Loud and The Buzz Report. Thank you very much. This has been fantastic.
This has been really
fun. Good to be back in the saddle with you again.
I missed you.
I want to be on Buzz Out Loud again.
Okay.
And I want you on Tech News Today.
All right. We were thinking of planning a big crossover event, a la NCIS and NCIS Los Angeles.
Or like when Allison Scagliotti was on Eureka.
Yeah, that time. When that happened.
Or when the Love Boat docked at Fantasy Island.
But yeah, I was thinking we gotta have one day where Tom is on Buzz Out Loud and then I'm on TNT and we just have a big blowout crossover event. It's going
to
be great.
But you realize in these crossover events, you have to have sort of a continual narrative. So you have to build a story.
True.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll get to work on that. And
that's
then maybe
not a problem.
Next Friday or something. We'll figure it out.
Leo Laporte will be back in the saddle, or rather on the ball, once again next week. Thanks to him for letting me fill in. This was really fun. And you can find us at twit.tv and watch us live every Sunday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, live.twit.tv. That does it for us. In that can is another twit. That's it.
That's it. We did it.
That was an interesting twist. That can is another tweet that was
in that can.
That was a good show. I need a cigarette.
That was meaty.
Yeah. Like, yeah, we got deep.
That was good real stuff.
Let's go around. Round the horn.